This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Friday, May 24th. I'm John Wanamaker. St. Paul officials say they're trying to determine what happened Wednesday when a landslide struck a popular fossil hunting spot and killed two fourth graders. Parks officials say they're closing the part of Lilydale Regional Park where the tragedy occurred. They don't know for sure what caused a section of bluff to let go and slide down onto a school field trip. City officials acknowledge that there was road and sewer work being done in the general area, but they don't think it played a role in the incident. Brad Meyer is a spokesman for the St. Paul Parks and Recreation Department.
The road realignment project is part of the Lilydale Regional Park Master Plan project, and that's completely away. Where the actual sewer work is up in Cherokee Park, and that's further east north of the bluff, so that's unrelated too.
Searchers recovered the body of the second boy from the landslide debris Thursday morning. Another two children were injured, one seriously. And the landslide has called into question the stability and safety of the city's iconic bluffs. The closure of the park will last at least 2 weeks while the city investigates what caused the landslide and how to make the park safer. Curtis Gilbert has more on that.
Peggy Lynch was devastated by the landslide, but not surprised. Lynch is the executive director of the Friends of the Parks and Trails of St. Paul and Ramsey County. She says the bluffs, which rise 30 to 40 feet above Lilydale Regional Park's fossil grounds, are inherently unstable.
The bluffs are fragile, and with the periods of rain we have, they just don't hold up.
Any steep slope is prone to erosion, and geologists say the soil of the bluffs is weak. The top layer is sand, and below it is a layer containing clay, which acts as a lubricant. When it's saturated with water, the ground can give way. Harvey Thorlifson has been fossil hunting in the park many times. He's the director of the Minnesota Geological Survey, and he says there's evidence of past landslides, albeit much smaller than this week's tragic event, all along the bottom of the bluff.
Well, you can see on the site where slabs of rock or sediment from above have fallen down. That's one of the factors that makes the site attractive to discover fossils that have fallen down.
Thorlifson is working with other geologists and engineers from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources to determine exactly what caused the landslide. The group will also advise the city on how to make the park safer. St. Paul officials say there were no signs the land on the top of the bluff was on the verge of collapse. They also say the magnitude of the landslide was unprecedented, at least in recent memory. The city says there have been no serious accidents in Lilydale Regional Park for at least 5 years. But outside the park, 2 miles away, along the same Mississippi River bluff, there was a close call a couple years ago. It was early in the morning on April 8, 2011, when Robert DeBoo arrived at his bakery, which sat right at the base of the bluffs on Wabasha Street. He smelled gas in the air and went to investigate. DeBoo made his way to the door of a large storage room.
Finally, I pushed the door and stuck my head in there, and it looked like a bomb had gone off, and a boulder the size of, two minivans was sitting in the back of the building.
The city condemned the structure that very night. DeBoo has since relocated his business, Bread, Coffee, and Cake, to Mendota Heights, and he's glad to be away from the bluffs.
It's a death zone, basically, and I think you have to look at it that way. And now with these children, hopefully there'll be a serious discussion about finding a solution to these problems so this never, ever happens again. It shouldn't have happened.
For now, the section of the park where the landslide happened remains closed indefinitely. But at a press conference yesterday, St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman made it clear he wants it to reopen eventually. Coleman lives at the top of the bluff, right across the street from the park. He says he goes there all the time.
I have gone in the rain, gone in the sunshine, I've gone in the snow. In these places. They're wonderful spaces, and for children to be able to explore and to collect fossils or to kind of get an understanding of the science of that area, I think is incredibly important.
Coleman says thousands of school children have explored the park safely over the years, and he wants more to have that opportunity in the future.
That was reporter Curtis Gilbert, and a fund has been set up at a St. Louis Park bank for the families of the two children killed in that landslide. The fourth graders who died were Haysem Sani and Mohamed Fofana. Reporter Rupa Shenoy visited with the Fofana family and has this report.
Mohamed Fofana lived with his grandmother, parents, and twin three-year-old brothers in a small house in North Minneapolis. Yesterday, family and friends crowded its rooms and lined the short hallways. In a small sitting area next to the kitchen, a group of women surrounded Mohamed's mother as she rocked back and forth. She didn't feel like talking, but she pointed to a homemade Mother's Day card pinned to the refrigerator. It read, "Dear Mom,
you're a wonderful cook. I love it when you make chicken with noodles. You are helpful. Thanks for cleaning and for washing my clothes. You are funny and tell great jokes."
He signed it Mohamed Fofana. The 10-year-old was the first member of his family born in the U.S. after they emigrated from Liberia and Guinea. Mohammed's two older brothers, who came to the U.S. after he was born, doted on him. They have their own apartment, but they would come by Mohammed's house nearly every day, often to take him to soccer practice. The eldest brother, Bafikane, said when he didn't visit enough, Mohamed would call and make up a reason for Bafi to come by. Bafi said young Mohamed knew what he wanted to do with his life.
Well, he basically said that he wanted to be a medical doctor. We asked him, "Why do you want to be a medical doctor?" He said he liked to help people.
Mohamed's other older brother, 21-year-old Gamo Kane, was playing soccer Wednesday when someone ran across the field yelling his name. Gamo said once he learned Mohamed was missing, he was frantic to help in the search. But officials on the scene at Lilydale Regional Park wouldn't allow the family near the collapsed bluff. They said it was too dangerous. Crews rescued two injured children and recovered the body of 9-year-old Haysem Sani. They continued search efforts the next morning and found Mohamed dead, buried in gravel and mud. Hours later, Gamo said he was still in disbelief.
"I haven't cried a lot because I still think it's all a dream to me."
Gamo Kane sat on the cement steps in front of the house, staring vacantly while a toddler cousin squirmed in his arms. He said he doesn't really understand the circumstances that led to his brother's death.
"He was the best kid that I ever been around. I'm sure every other kid, everybody thinks the same way about their kids. And it's tragic, but as a believer in God, I believe it was the will of God. And there's no one that can stop it, and it happened. So you just got to stay strong and still believe."
Mohamed spent 6 hours every weekend studying Islam with his mother's uncle, Imam Mohamed Dukli. Dukli said Mohammed's parents also have a new faith in the U.S. They were surprised and grateful for the resources officials marshaled in the attempt to rescue Mohamed.
"I've seen these things on TV, but to be there to see how these individuals perform, risking their own lives in order to rescue someone, this is amazing."
Dukli says the kindness of officials who came to the house to console the family has made an impression on the small, tight-knit Ghanaian community. Delphine Asimoda is from the same city in Guinea as Mohamed's parents. She stood on their porch quietly. Asimoda said it was her responsibility to be there.
"We are like a family here, like just one family. When you say Guinea, it's just a family. And we all come together for one person, you know. We are all one family."
Asimoda says this family hasn't had a death in the short time since they came to the U.S. 10-year-old Mohamed's funeral will be their first. Rupa Shenoy, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. A key source of revenue in Minnesota's freshly minted budget is a new higher income tax rate that the top 2% of earners will pay. The tax increase moves the top rate from nearly 8% to nearly 10%. Minnesota Public Radio's Mark Zadeklik spoke with some people who will see their taxes go up and has this report.
At the top of a hill, past a gardener planting shrubs on a beautifully groomed lawn, then inside, through a marble-floored foyer, Mike Tierney sits at his kitchen table. He lives in Deep Haven, just off of Lake Minnetonka. He's retired, having done very well for himself in the injection molding business. He strongly disputes the notion Minnesota's tax system is now fairer because people like him will be paying more.
"I'd like to have anyone define what is a fair share."
Tierney says the new tax will cost him thousands more every year.
"It definitely will come out of somewhere. I doubt if we're going to get rid of a car, we're going to stop traveling, or we're going to change our lifestyle very much."
Tierney says he'll probably reduce charitable giving to make up for the higher income tax bill.
"Whether it's the Guthrie or the Chamber Orchestra or the 9 million other people who call every day looking for donations.
Increasing income taxes on the wealthy was Mark Dayton's core promise during his 2010 campaign for governor.
The rich can afford to pay their fair share. They should be paying their fair share. And if I'm governor, they will pay their fair share.
To back up his fair share argument, Dayton cites revenue department studies that show top earners pay a lower percentage of their income in taxes than do middle and low-income Minnesotans. Critics of the new higher tax say it threatens to drive away people like Tierney, who they say will move to lower tax states. But studies have concluded tax increases are not a major reason why wealthy people move. Tierney says he has no intention of leaving Minnesota. That's not the case for the owner of a printing company in the northwestern suburbs who's begun staking out an exit plan.
It motivated me to sit down with our attorneys at Fredrickson Byron and our tax accountants to talk about not having a Minnesota residency just because of the cost.
The printing company owner agreed to an interview but didn't want his name used out of fear state tax collectors might single him out. He said changing his residency would save him enough money to cover a substantial part of a new condo in, say, Naples, Florida, where there is no income tax.
In some ways, I feel guilty about it. I'm very tied to Minnesota. I love Minnesota. I've spent my whole life here. But when someone gives you a piece of paper and says, here's how much you'd save, it's hard to resist that pull.
The business owner says it's a mistake for the 98% of Minnesotans who won't be paying the bill to discount it as no big deal for the top earners who will.
I know a lot of folks think of that as being just, oh, that's just 2 more percent. But most folks in business would look at that and say, well, that just went up 20%.
Actually, 25%. Lori Barber has done the math too, but she's come to a different conclusion.
For me to pay a little more, so the person that I was 10 years ago doesn't have to, I'm happy to do that.
A decade ago, Barber was broke, immobilized with arthritis, and getting government help to feed her family. Now she and her husband have a lucrative consulting business. She is also a full-time elementary school teacher. And when she's at her South Minneapolis school, she's surrounded by kids who have very little, including these young students who've just sat down for lunch in the basement cafeteria.
97% of these kids get free or reduced lunches. That's what my money's going for, is give these kids the same opportunity that my children had.
Barbara says she and her husband have considered moving elsewhere, but she says it's clear to them that high-tax states like Minnesota are better places to be.
In other states that where they don't have the taxes, they don't have the educational system we have. They don't have the best medicine. They don't have the best businesses.
The new top-tier 9.85% income tax rate takes effect this year and is projected to raise more than $500 million annually. With it, Minnesota ranks as having the fourth highest income tax rates in the nation. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And Governor Dayton has line item vetoed two outdoor projects in the legacy bill passed by the legislature, one providing funding for habitat in the metro area and the other targeting aquatic invasive species. The governor says he responded to citizen pressure to drop funding for the two items. Stephanie Hemphill has more.
The $6.3 million for habitat restoration in the metro area was mostly aimed at land and water in parks. The Lisard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, which reviews and recommends projects to the legislature, gave the restoration plan low marks. The Outdoor Heritage Council never saw the other project for $3 million to fight aquatic invasive species. The governor's veto message acknowledges he made a deal with legislative leaders near the end of the session to approve the two items. But he immediately got a lot of mail and phone calls from outdoor and conservation groups saying he was betraying a long-standing promise to respect the council's decisions. One of the legislators involved in the end-of-session deal was DFL Representative Phyllis Kahn of Minneapolis. Kahn chairs the House Legacy Committee, and she says Dayton caved to the pressure.
It's, you know, essentially this bullying approach from one sports writer, one ex-football coach, and these groups that heavily benefit from their relationship with the Outdoor Heritage Council.
The sports writer is outdoors columnist Dennis Anderson of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, who wrote several columns criticizing the legislative additions. The ex-football coach is Bud Grant, who publicly urged Dayton to veto the measures. And the groups include many hunting and fishing and conservation organizations. Kahn says the Outdoor Heritage Council is prejudiced against the metro area. She says just because most of the metro area habitat is located in parks, that shouldn't disqualify them for habitat restoration money.
Metropolitan area is a major part of the Mississippi Flyway, which is the most internationally renowned part of Minnesota State's natural heritage map. That duck that gets shot in Crow Wing County probably stopped for lunch and breakfast in Hennepin County or Dakota County.
One of the groups that urged Dayton to veto the money is the Nature Conservancy. Isis Stark is director of government relations for the organization in Minnesota, South Dakota, and North Dakota. She says the council is not biased against metro area projects.
They don't try to have a project everywhere in the state. They try to look at the best project so that the citizens feel like they are going to be leaving a legacy at the end of the 25 years of funding. So we can see what we paid for when we passed that amendment.
Stark says polling data indicate the overwhelming majority of Minnesotans agree with that approach. On the project related to aquatic invasive species, Stark says the state should come up with general fund money to deal with that problem, separate from the legacy amendment money. The legacy amendment is funded by a portion of sales tax revenue set aside to improve the environment.
This constitutional amendment says that the states should not be substituting traditional sources of money. And in the past, before this funding was available, we had invasive species and we had to fund them. And we should continue to do that from other sources of funding.
This is not the first time the legislature has deviated from Lessard Council recommendations. In recent years, legislators have added funding for emerald ash borer and Asian carp problems. They were not vetoed. The outstate versus metro fight is unlikely to be resolved anytime soon. Conservation groups say the metro area has received 10% of outdoors funding each year since the beginning, while it only represents 3.5% of the state's land mass. But metro advocates say most of the money from the sales tax comes from metro area residents, and the metro is where more young people can be introduced to the outdoors. The metro parks and groups concerned about aquatic invasive species can apply for outdoors funding again next year. Stephanie Hempel, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And the Memorial Day weekend is just about here when many Minnesotans head north on clogged highways to their summer cabins. With the long winter and late ice out on many lakes, for some this could be the first visit since last fall. Our reporter Dan Crocker recently tagged along as one family opened up the cabin that's provided a summer retreat to four generations.
So this is the cabin. This is the main room.
The scene could be on a postcard. The simple brown cabin looks out on a narrow bay of an isolated lake. A giant old-growth red pine towers overhead. A loon pops to the lake's tranquil surface. Peggy Marshall pulls open the door on the cast-iron wood stove to start this annual rite.
Let me build a little fire in here. Take the chill off.
Every summer for more than 40 years, Marshall's come here. This two-room cabin with a small screen porch still has no running water. Only a year ago, the place got electricity thanks to a small solar panel, but there's only one outlet and just three lights. Peggy and her 29-year-old son Bill live about an hour south in Grand Rapids. After driving up, they get right to work, first lighting the fire and hauling water. Then they put in the dock, even though it's sleeting outside. That's just what the Marshalls do on the first day.
Mom, are you okay?
Yeah, I'm good.
For Peggy Marshall, the cabin's routines date back to 1968, when her parents bought the place.
Yeah, I was 10 years old, and we were really excited about buying it. I mean, us kids wanted that cabin really badly because it was just like a playhouse.
Back then, it was a real trek to the playhouse. Her father, Bill Muir, was a botany professor at Carleton College in Northfield, 260 miles to the south. Shortly after they bought the cabin, he lost his eyesight to diabetes. He only saw the place a couple times, but that didn't dampen his enthusiasm for wilderness. He eventually paddled more than 2,000 miles in the boundary waters and testified in Washington to keep the canoe area motor-free. and the family headed north nearly every weekend.
He always worked till way late on a Friday, and my mom would work with him because she was his eyes after he went blind. And then we'd drive up here in the middle of the night and get here at like 2 in the morning.
The journey was even longer in the winter.
We had to walk the last mile. They didn't plow this road. And so we'd have snowshoes and we'd pull little plastic toboggans behind us. And it was a mile in and on snowshoes with 4 kids and a blind man and my mom.
At 3 or 4 in the morning.
3 or 4 in the morning.
The family spent a sabbatical year together in the original structure, which had only one room. 6 people in one room. No electricity, no running water.
We all lived up here through the whole winter. And it was not very well insulated. We had styrofoam boxes glued to the ceiling and or some places, and we had mice. We'd take our wash our hair at night and then go to bed, and we'd wake up in the morning with our hair frozen to the wall.
Her younger brother, only 12 at the time, led construction on a new cabin. Her father inspected the work with his hands to ensure it met his specifications, even though he had never built anything before either. But they finished it, 4 kids and a blind man, and it's still standing solidly. They didn't add plumbing and electricity when they had the chance. The family even fought to keep power out of the area to ensure it wouldn't be developed. So was it worth it? Is it worth it? The work, the weather, roughing it? Both Peggy and her son Bill pause.
But yeah, it's definitely a significant part of my life. It's hard to imagine what my childhood would have been like without having the cabin.
Every time I come up here, I think, why do I not come up here more often? And when you get here, it's just so wonderful. It's just such a getaway, and everything that you have to do at home is left behind, and it's just a letting go of responsibility.
And that's a feeling 4 generations of Marshalls have shared.
Huge piece of our family. I mean, both my family growing up and my children, and now the grandkids, carrying on that tradition of going to the cabin.
Peggy's father, Bill Muir, took his last trip to the cabin in 1985. He died in his beloved wilderness getaway that summer. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Itasca County.
And to see some pictures of the Marshalls' cabin and hear how the family stopped bulldozers in their tracks to prevent electric service from coming through, visit nprnews.org. You can also find a link there to share and look at cabin photos. And that's the NPR News update for Friday, May 24th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.